Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're bringing to you a project, a product, and a book.
But the common denominator between all of them is they're all really, really fascinating people with the interesting stories that they shared with us. One about wine, one about candy, and one about how to cook for a superstar athlete. Sounds like quite a program for the day, sweetheart. I guess we better get going, huh?
Excellent. We start with Randall Graham, who's one of our most favorite guests and certainly a unique personality. Randall Graham, you're never short of surprises, but you totally shocked me rigid with this latest project.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, she's rigid, I can promise you.
I jumped on it immediately, and I thought, I don't understand this, and I don't even think it's possible. But let's go back to, let's talk about the name of it, Popoluchum Estate. Oh, go ahead.
Sure. The pronunciation that I use is Popoluchum. which is a Mutsun Indian indigenous people's name for the area around San Juan Bautista, where the vineyard is located.
Where is that?
San Juan Bautista is about 50 minutes south, pretty much due south of San Jose, and about 50 minutes southeast of Santa Cruz. So it's just off of Highway 101.
Okay, now for people who don't know, which is a stretch, you are a well-respected and we will say level-headed wine
mostly.
Producer, mostly level-headed wine producer, and a brand that's also well-known called Bonnie Doon. And this is going to be like a whole new direction in your life, a whole new, I've never heard of anything even like it as a project. Now, from that point, explain what you're trying to do.
Certainly. I've been very fortunate to work in the wine business for more than 30 years, and it's been fun and great and satisfying. But I've sort of reached a point in my life where I was not really satisfied with what I had achieved and really where I was going. I really wanted to make wines of a very different quality than the ones I was making. And my model is, in fact, the European wines. The French have this notion of what they call a vin de terroir, a wine of place, that a wine can somehow capture the intrinsic qualities of a place and reflect those qualities in the wine itself. And it's the soil characteristics, it's the aspect of the vineyard, other aspects as well, but it gives that wine a uniqueness, both a uniqueness as well as a depth and a complexity that could not otherwise be achieved. Just don't find those qualities in, let's call them, technical wines or mass-produced wines or wines that are manipulated or come from a lot of different areas and are blended together. Those could be very nice wines, but they don't have that individuality. So that's the kind of wine that I aspired to make. The question really was, how do you do it?
Well, let's start with where. How did you figure out where to do it?
Well, that's a good question, too. I mean, obvious question would be move to Europe and find a great vineyard site, yeah. But that wasn't really practical. I live in California, and my family's in California, so I really need to do it here. And I've been looking for land. I had been looking for land for quite some time until I found a beautiful parcel in San Benito County just outside the little town of San Juan Bautista. San Juan Bautista is a tiny little town. It's best known for its mission. It has a beautiful mission, which was pictured in the Hitchcock movie Vertigo. That's its main claim to fame. And oddly enough, I dreamt about this place before I saw it. And then, of course, when I saw it, I recognized it. And this seemed to be a very propitious sign.
I would say so.
Yes. I don't think I could ask for any better confirmation than that.
Is this better than packing poop and a hornet the full moon with biodiversity? But you will do that, of course, won't you?
We're going to do that
as
well.
I mean, not biodiversity. You know,
biodynamics, yeah.
Biodynamic. So you're going to do it on that principle. And what are the aspects of this terroir, this region, that attracted you to it?
Well, the soils are extremely interesting. There, because it's on the right on the San Andreas Fault, there's been a lot of interesting geological activity. A lot of the soils have been moved up and down and mixed up, and so there's a lot of really interesting geology and several extremely distinctive soil types that are interesting soil types that are on the property. There's some beautiful limestone soils that are follow the same stratum of soil that Josh Jensen has at Calera. There's some beautiful granitic soils and some beautiful volcanic soils. And all of these are soils or terroirs that have the potential to be quite articulate and expressive, if you will.
Now, but you carry this a little further. It's not just that you're going to plant vines that express this particular terroir. You are going to actually create a wholly new type of grape, right?
Well, this is unique. Your listeners are going to need to follow carefully and maybe sit themselves down before they do.
Yeah.
There's a couple of interesting aspects to this project. One is we're going to breed 10,000 new grape varieties, and there's essentially two slightly divergent aims to this project, but they kind of come together in the end. And you can think of it almost really as two different bets. Bet number one, which is a little more easier to understand, is if you breed 10,000 grapes, amongst this 10,000 you might find a few, two or four or five or ten, that are particularly well suited to the site, that are absolutely congruent, that just seem exceptionally happy on the site. And further, individual varieties that might be really interesting for the world at large, that have unique flavor characteristics or unique agronomic properties like drought tolerance or disease resistance or other aspects that make them interesting beyond my application. So that's bet number one. Bet number two, which is a little more difficult to understand and maybe somewhat theoretical, is this. That is, would it be a reasonable strategy to make a field blend of a very, very large population of genetically distinctive individuals? And in so doing, would that be a reasonable strategy to actually better express soil characteristics? So in other words, by suppressing varietal characteristics, is this a mechanism for allowing other qualities in the wine to emerge?
And
so it's a strategy for allowing soil characteristics to emerge, and also a strategy for perhaps creating complexity, nuance, small variations in between the grapes that will give you some kind of complexity that you could not otherwise achieve.
Now, Randall, field blending is not a new term to me. I've heard of it being done in other parts of the wine world. But I had the impression that by field blending, that simply meant that the winemaker was, if you like, going apeshit and putting together things in a barrel that you ordinarily wouldn't put together.
Well, no, actually, field blend per se is harvesting the entire contents of the field all at once and mixing them together. So, but these are vineyards that were originally intentionally planted that way to be harvested together. So, for example,
I see. Okay.
You wouldn't grow Pinot Noir and Cabernet Sauvignon in the same field because, they have different requirements. As importantly, they ripen at very different times. So the things that, if you're doing a field blend, a proper field blend, everything needs to ripen more or less at the same time to be harvested together and fermented together.
But what you want to come out of this is an entity, a vine, that has all these characteristics.
Well, as I said, there's two good outcomes. And I'd be happy with either outcome. And frankly, the field blend part is going to be the one that I'm going to see first. That's something that's achievable earlier. And as far as identifying the genius grape variety, I may or may not live long enough to see that. I mean, that might take quite some time to emerge. And maybe no one, myself included, would even have the wit to discover this unique variety. I think, you know, if you have 10,000 grapes, what are you looking for?
Well,
I mean, obviously...
What are you?
I mean, you could look for the gross characteristics, which are, you know, maybe it's a smaller cluster, or, you know, it has higher acidity, or it ripens earlier. Those are the things that are easily discernible. But what about the subtle qualities? I mean, how are you going to discern these very subtle qualities? So, luckily, I'm going to have some time to figure out how to discern these things, because it's going to take a while. But it's not at all obvious how you really discover these very subtle aspects.
Yeah, I mean, I told you that there was just, it took 20 years to breed this one apple combining two different apples with properties. About how many years is it going to take for you to do this expression of the terroir with this wine?
Well, hold on. There's a term that you snuck in there.
Oh, terroir.
No, the genius blend.
Oh, yeah,
You snuck that in there. So let me be simplistic here, just because I want you to give a clearer definition of what you mean by a genius blend.
I mean a genius grape. Or by a genius grape, I'm using the term loosely, but a sense that a grape that has a distinctiveness There's actually, when you talk about noble grapes or brilliant grapes or wonderful grapes, there's actually, in a sense, two different senses of the term. There's a genius grape in the sense of Pinot Noir, which is that under certain conditions it can produce a wine of fabulous complexity and nuance. That's one, a Riesling for that matter. And then there's another sense of the word, like Cabernet Sauvignon or Chardonnay, which in and of themselves are not necessarily the most interesting grapes from a flavor standpoint, or the most complex grapes, but they are adaptable to a lot of different situations. They can be grown in a lot of different climates successfully, in different soils successfully, and to that extent, they're a very useful grape. So a grape is either useful or it's particular, and if it meets either of those criteria, then it benefits from.
Thank you for that explanation, because I think listeners will understand it better now you've defined it in terms of grape varieties which are particularly popular, Pinot Noir being one of those. But then you said, but there are other grapes which are useful, and when you say useful, what really happens is the genius of the winemaker in this case is added to the characteristics of the grape to produce a totally brilliant wine, which has both human and, if you like, botanical genius.
Exactly, which is what happens in Bordeaux. And in fact, in the southern areas, in the warmer areas, the Mediterranean areas, one of the things you find consistently, in virtually every instance, seldom, if ever, find a wine made from 100% of a particular grape. It's always a blend. And so you could think of it in a certain sense that none of these individual grapes have the distinctiveness in and of themselves to make a wine complex enough, that you really need to blend different things together to make a really complex wine. One for acidity, one for tannin, one for weight or color, and each one brings something to the conversation.
And one of the criticisms of the wines of California, for example, and Australia for that matter, in Australia Shiraz grapes, and in California in particular Cabernet Sauvignon, they are criticized because they're one dimensional. So however brilliant they are as an expression of just Cabernet Sauvignon, that doesn't mean, in a sense, that they're satisfying enough.
Right, and I think this is the challenge in a Mediterranean climate. In a Mediterranean climate, it is very, and especially with these particular varieties, it is very difficult to make a monocépage that really has the complexity that you're looking for. And then also, then there's the quality of how the grapes are grown, that whether you call them soil characteristics or terroir, that's that other dimension to dimensionality to the wine that I think makes is the difference between a good wine and an extraordinary wine.
Well, you know, terroir, of course, encompasses a lot more than, you know, the where it's facing and the aspects of the soil. And you're going to be doing this as if there are not enough variables. You're doing this in an era of great climate change.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You know, it, you could, one, I'm completely bummed out by climate change, but on the other hand, it's also an opportunity, and that is, in fact, one of the issues that I'm trying to address in this initiative. By the way, we should at some point mention the
crowdfunding.
I think
you should do that now, because I
okay.
think...
Well, I was coming to that next, but just to back up just a second, just to give it a context, my guess is that your climate change from the point of view of grapes is expressed in temperature more than anything else probably. So if you like, in a sense, what you're looking for is the next Grenache and the next Tempranillo, both of those being grapes that thrive in what are reasonably difficult conditions because it's really hot and is really dry.
Exactly. So we're looking, in this initiative, we're looking to identify, to work primarily with grapes that have certain properties of drought tolerance and heat tolerance and disease resistance. And one of the exciting aspects is that I'm fairly certain we're going to be able to build on the work of Professor Andy Walker at UC Davis, who has gone a long way in identifying, or not in identifying, in actually breeding new varieties of grapes that are resistant to very important diseases like Pierce's disease and powdery mildew. Mm-hmm. And if we can incorporate that germplasm in our work, we can also significantly improve the health of these vines and make these vines more sustainable in the sense that they won't require the same kind of inputs to keep them healthy. And also potentially open up these varieties for new areas that could not otherwise grow vinifera, like in the southeast, for example.
Well, now let's go back to the really important thing. There's this wicked saying in California in particular that says, how do I make $2 million in growing grapes in Napa Valley? And the answer is you start with five.
Yes, exactly.
But you've got a rather unique way of approaching this financial hurdle. So talk to us about that, because listeners, this is a place where you can actually get involved yourself and buy a little grubstake in this adventure if you so choose.
Great. Thank you, Peter, for bringing it up. We've launched a crowdfunding initiative about a week ago to raise some money for this project. It's on Indiegogo, and if you go to the Indiegogo site and you, I think, type in Popol Vuh, the URL address is a little complicated, but it's if you Google Popol Vuh, that's Popelouchum, and Indiegogo, I'm sure you'll get to the site without too much drama. And we're trying to raise money. The whatever we raise is really literally, quite literally, seed money. It's a small amount of what we ultimately will need, but at least it's building awareness for the project, building a community around the project, which is another way of saying customers. I guess politically less correct way of saying, politically more correct way of saying customers for the future. And with luck, we can maybe produce a really unusual wine that has not existed before.
Now you've got it, but it's not a conventional Kickstarter model even, because you have two parts. You have a phase one, which you just described, but then there's going to be another one right after it.
Well, what we're actually hoping to do, not hoping, we're planning, intending with great intention, is to create a nonprofit entity, a 501c3 entity, which really would properly fund this and be able to bring in much greater investment as a nonprofit. Because this really will be a truly a nonprofit venture.
Yeah, and you're looking at 10, 12 years, and then possibly longer, right?
That's correct, yes.
Now, won't it be interesting to see the kinds of talent? Will there be opportunities for you to involve and draw in all kinds of talent in your community, not customer, but talent working in the community?
Well, there is a great opportunity. I mean, we're working with, it's not even just the new grape varieties that will be available, because they won't be available for a while, but, you know, really what we're trying to model is sustainability on a number of levels. We're working on developing strategies for dry farming, in other words, growing without irrigation. And if we can work that out successfully and share those results and those techniques with other people, we'll have done a service. We're also growing some really interesting produce there above and beyond grapes. We're growing row crops and fruit trees. And we're using an interesting material called biochar, which is essentially activated charcoal and compost. And that's having some really, we're having extremely good results with that. As far as enhancing the water holding capacity of our soils and the nutritional aspect of the produce that we're growing. Wow. So that's quite exciting.
Well, I mean, this is, I said, a whole new future for you, really. I mean, it's the project becomes in essence a whole new life.
Yes.
Are you going to continue the Bonnie Doon Vineyard label?
Don't know. I mean, ultimately, I'm very sort of psychically attached to Bonnie Doon, but and if it's necessary to you know, financially, if we need to keep another brand going to kind of keep the lights on, we'll do it. But ultimately, my intention is really to focus on the San Juan project. I mean, that's really what and one of the thoughts I had was we can take some of the grapes that we grow right now for Bonnie Doon for Cigar Volant, for example, and grow those in San Juan and continue making Cigar Volant, maybe under a slightly new imprimatur.
Yeah, you had a sort of a slightly whacked out approach to putting things in the barrel anyway, didn't you?
Indeed, yes. Indeed.
we might as well tell it like it is. I mean, It's such a shame that you and Joseph Grosvenor might never meet.
Not for want of trying.
Yeah,
I tried to meet him maybe four or five times.
Yeah. You have tried.
Yeah, I mean, we did too. I mean, we met his wife, but his children, but never him.
He doesn't like people. He automatically assumes that people are trying to steal his ideas.
Oh, dear. Wow.
Instead of just making them available to the world.
No, you two would have a wonderful conversation, I'm sure.
Yes.
Now, are you going to have, everybody, we're going to put the information about how to get in touch to contribute money on our website. But also, are you going to have a newsletter or a website where people could stay in touch with developments with the project?
Absolutely. I mean, right now it's the Indiegogo site that is the repository of all the information. And there's an insanely diverse amount. There's a lot of information on that site. It's a very dense site. So everything you ever wanted to learn about grape breeding and terroir, there's a lot of information on the site. When the campaign ends, we're undoubtedly going to have to. It'll transfer to the Popol Vuh site, so that will be the repository at that point.
Well, this is all very exciting, but you never fail to excite and stimulate Randall Graham, and we can't wish you enough luck. I mean, it's going to be a huge, long involvement.
Yeah, I want to end up our conversation with two thoughts. The first one, and I said this off the air before I came on, but it seems to me, Randall, and you have the writing skills to do this, by the way, as well, that it's the equivalent of writing a sequel to something like Gone with the Wind, or what's the one I was thinking of?
To Kill a Mockingbird.
but here's an even more interesting story. Back in the 14th century, the poet Dante Alighieri was thrown out of Florence for writing nasty things about people. And
yes.
And he's a good friend of yours anyway, because you paraphrased Divine Comedy. What the secret, what you don't know, this is the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would have it, is that the male line of the Alighieris ran out about three or four generations after Dante.
Oh, dear.
But there was fortunately there were female offspring,
and they
married, but they did something even smarter, and they traded their name with their husbands.
So the
name Alighieri has continued on the property that Dante fled to when he left Florence in the 14th century, and it's being farmed and run by the Masi, that's M-A-S-I. Vineyard family, but they make an Alighieri Chianti.
Oh my gosh! Cool.
We just drank the last bottle.
Did we?
But I thought it was a fascinating story, and surely you will think of something similar to do along the way if you haven't already done so.
Well, I'll bring this up with my 12-year-old daughter first opportunity. Give her plant a seed for.
Make sure you don't ever change.
There you go. Just in case you don't have any boys.
Probably unlikely at this juncture, but you know, one never knows, I suppose.
Randall Graham, you are always such a fine entertainment,
and such a deep thinker. I mean, it really captured my imagination the minute you said it, and I hope it captures everybody else, and they all start sending in money.
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for taking the interest. It's really appreciated.
Well, I'm fascinated, and I look forward to following your progress.
Lovely. Cool. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Randall.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
And it seems to me we could have talked to Randall for even longer.
He's always got
such a fascinating tale to tell, but we need to take a break, and we'll be right back, so don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up, we have somebody who's going to, it's probably my newest best friend forever, is Laurie Parker, especially also if she shares with me forever her not-too-sweet candy snacks, which I adore.
There you go.
But Laurie, in addition to making candy, has a lot of different life experiences to share, lots of stories to tell. Let's listen to Laurie. Occasionally we get somebody who's so interesting to talk to, I could spend days. And we have somebody like that on the line right now, Laurie Parker of Laurie and Sons.
In fact, we forgot to turn the recorder on.
Oh.
No, we didn't. 2 minutes ago, we didn't. I didn't turn it on. Now I have it on now. Don't worry.
Okay. All right. Well, we were talking with Laurie about her recent mission, Malawi in Africa. But what we're really supposed to be talking to her about is this delicious candy. It's, first of all, I guess I ought to know, how many sons are we talking, Laurie?
I have 3 sons, and they're all active in the business in sort of different capacities.
Like what? I mean, how old are they?
The oldest one is 24, and he has become our social media and PR expert, which is an area that he's interested in. My middle son is 20, Johnny, and he's become a sort of a crackerjack salesperson and helps a lot with our demos and following up with customers and talking with people. And my youngest son is something of a handy person with building things and mechanics, and so he helps us to keep the kitchen running smoothly and can fix anything with just a screwdriver. It's amazing.
Well, you're lucky to have that assortment of sons.
It's wonderful.
But now you're in Harlem, New York, which is not known as being the confectionery capital of the United States, I wouldn't have thought.
It's very interesting. We're in East Harlem, and we're cooking at a historic location called La Marqueta, which is the original market in East Harlem from many years ago. And the landlord for the market is now the City of New York, and they have an interest in supporting food manufacturing because there are a lot of jobs that go along with that. And they recently renovated La Marqueta into step-up commercial kitchen facilities. And we put in a competitive bid for one of three spaces, and we were awarded the lease last May. And we've been, you know, running ever since, and we're very happy to be in there with other interesting and energetic and award-winning companies doing interesting things with food.
Winnie, you have not always been a chocolatier or a confectioner. Tell us the backstory here. How did this happen?
Sure. Well, my background is marketing and advertising, but when the boys were little, and there were three of them, it eventually became too much for me to handle work and family, so I decided to spend some time with the kids, which I did, and I, you know, they really were the inspiration for this. I wanted to be able to give them delicious things to eat and snacks and treats, but I wanted them to be really good quality things made with organic sugar and healthier ingredients, and I started making my own candies. And over time, they became my taste testers, and we kind of developed an area of expertise in toffees and brittles, which was something that they very much enjoyed, and chocolate, which is kind of the foundation of the whole enterprise.
Well, now, I told you, well, you won, what was your Sophie, the gold Sophie for this delivery?
Yes, outstanding chocolate category.
Which is
for the dangerously delicious black licorice chocolate toffee.
Well, I mean, I have to tell you that I already did tell you I am not a sweets person. I'm not by any means a candy person. And when I bit into that particular product, I said, this is the best thing I've ever eaten, which is amazing. So, and you got a gold medal for that, which is, I think I read there were something 110 entries into the best chocolate or the outstanding chocolate Sophie award for this specialty.
We were just thrilled. We loved the product, and to win in a category like that that's so competitive, there's so many wonderful chocolate makers and candy makers out there. We are still flying from the whole event. It's really exciting.
Now, how did you even find out about licorice? I mean, licorice is loved or hated, for that matter, by the population in my native land, and the Queen of England, as I mentioned to you earlier on, has a standing order for Trapea, Italy, which is in Calabria, for the licorice that comes from there, which is supposed to be some of the best in the world. But it's not seen a lot on candy store shelves, is it?
It's this year's Fancy Food Show was a lot of places in the Fancy Food Show.
Yeah, it's interesting. There was a beverage using licorice. Well, I actually used to have a candy when I was a child that my grandfather would give me that had black licorice in it. It was a black licorice caramel. And
I thought
it was the most wonderful thing that I had ever had, and I always sort of kept in the back of my mind the idea of experimenting with this and the toffee, because the combination of the black licorice is so softened by the butter content of the toffee that it's wonderful. And I started experimenting with this and worked on it, I guess, for about 6 or 7 months, and the boys, who are not fans of black licorice at all, came around, and that's when we knew that we had something.
Well, you sure do. It's heavenly. Unfortunately, everybody else gobbled it up. We had the grandchildren here, and they gobbled up every piece of candy that we had.
Here's the deal: of all the products which came in during this wave of the Sophie Awards and associated activities, this was the one that disappeared the first. And I will admit, quite honestly, I contributed to that.
Well, you should be ashamed of
yourself. I should be ashamed of myself. Well, if the Queen can have licorice, why can't I?
Right.
Laurie, I think you should send a sample to the Queen of England.
You know, that's a great idea.
Yeah, do that.
I mean,
that's a great idea.
Hey, you give it to one of your sons as a project.
Do you think it's possible for her to assign her royal mark to a non British company?
Probably not.
Yeah,
probably not. Okay.
You're obviously familiar with candies and products around the world because by appointment to Her Majesty the Queen, or His Majesty the King for that matter, it is in fact a much sought after label, sort of like winning a gold Sophie, if you like.
Yes.
But you're right. I don't think it would necessarily work for you to become a supplier, but you never can tell. She can certainly...
She could probably supply, but she wouldn't get the designation.
You wouldn't get the... It's worth a try. I think her oldest son should give it a shot.
we'd be okay with that. It would be a thrill.
Send an email to buckinghampalace.gov or whatever it is.
Yes.
you can bet him a small wager just to make sure that he really tries seriously to make that happen.
So you jumped into making this, and then how did you learn about the business end of all of this?
That has really been from very much small business, trial and error. The one thing that's so wonderful about food businesses is the collegiality of other companies, and people really do talk and share, and they'll share resources like insurance brokers or suggestions on pricing or graphic designers. And there's a real desire to see people do well, and we've benefited hugely from this big population in New York, in Brooklyn, and also now growing in Harlem of young entrepreneurial food companies. And there really is this sharing going on.
It's wonderful.
So that's been tremendous.
And do you know Sean Askenasi?
Yes.
Because he does products where he partners with specific other producers.
Well, he does work like the work you were talking about when you just went on your trip to Malawi. He actually has a college.
He's done tremendous work, and I understand that he was just appointed to the Clinton Foundation organization.
Yes, he was.
Which was tremendous. He has a very innovative model for his company, and we've been interested in working with increasing wages for female cocoa farmers, and we're working with Oxfam on that piece of it. And then we're interested in bringing better food production techniques to Malawi and helping the local people be able to preserve more of their food so that it's less of a seasonal thing for them. And that's the effort there.
Well, I think you have a great time and a lot of fun in store for you, as well as a lot of hard work with this, all the stuff that's opening up in your daily life with your work.
It's wonderful. And, of course, we're coming out of our summer. You know, summer is, there's less chocolate consumed. It's seasonal. But we're coming into the very exciting period of time for the holidays, and that is just, it's nonstop and roller coaster, but lots of fun.
Right. Now, maybe we should mention some of the other products besides Dangerously Delicious.
We do have other toffees. Our classic and the bestseller is still our dark chocolate-covered toffee with sea salt from Maine. The salt is hand-harvested by a fellow who lives up in Marshfield, Maine, and has a delicious crunch to the flakes, and so that is our bestseller, the chocolate with dark sea salt. We also have a version with milk chocolate. We have another one, Moroccan Spice, which is a real popular one with people that like a little bit of heat, and it has cinnamon and cayenne in it to give it a real pop, and then we have red pepper flakes on the top.
Yeah,
so you know what you're getting into.
I wolfed those down, too.
You mean we got some of those, and
oh,
I
sure.
didn't even get to taste
sure,
them?
Sure, I ate all those, too.
Oh, shoot.
And then on the other side of the scale, we have a twist on a traditional brittle, and this brittle is baked brittle. Instead of taking it all the way through on the kettle, on the stove, we started on the stove and developed a delicious caramelized flavor, and then we move it into the oven where it's baked into this very light, crunchy brittle that doesn't stick to your teeth, doesn't break your teeth, tastes delicious, and it actually has some ingredients in it that are a little bit better for you, so it's an even healthier version. We've taken down the sugar by adding in some brown rice flour, and we're getting lots of interest there as well.
That's interesting, too. Yeah, well, that was another trend I noted, is the dropping the sugar content was a big thing, I know.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, there's been a big, major war on sugar.
Well, now we've answered all the important questions, except the most important one of all, which is...
What's next?
How do you lay your hands on some?
Oh, right, we need to talk about that. How do people get your product?
Thank you. Yes, well, we have, for starters, we have a shop on our website where people can order on LoriandSons.com, which makes it very easy. But we're also in many...
It's spelled out. A-N-D is spelled out.
Yes, thank you very much. It is spelled out. So it's LauriandSons.com. And we're also selling in many specialty food stores and continually expanding the number of places that we're working with. We have a store out in San Francisco. We have one in Nantucket. So we're very excited to be sort of spreading our wings. Saratoga Springs up in New York. We're heading up to Maine as well. So it's a very exciting time for us.
Well, I can't tell you how pleased I am to have encountered you and your products. Or I mean, your products and you, too.
Thank you very much.
Yes. And so I guess you have your work cut out for you in the future.
Yeah, it's going to be busy, but it's going to be a lot of fun. And it's exciting. We're working with lots of talented people. In addition to my sons, I have a number of young women who have come into the business, and I'm teaching them about, chocolate making and confections. And we're doing workshops with commercial toffee production. And so it's very exciting, and you meet just so many wonderful people. It's really the most exciting thing of all.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to us and for letting us sample your products. And, and keep us posted on what you're doing next.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Anne, and thank you, Peter. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Peter, for one, has always wondered what it is that these professional athletes, the superstars, what is it that they eat that helps them be so good at what they do on the court? And we had the opportunity, I don't know that we even realized we were doing this to begin with, because we just got a fascinating new cookbook called Method of Procedure, which didn't exactly sound
like
a cookbook.
Which I still don't understand what it means.
I don't understand
right.
It either. But we sure thought you would share our interest in finding out what it was that... being the personal chef for Shaquille O'Neal of the Orlando Magic and then the L.A. Lakers, what was that really like? What was it that he used to eat? And what is it, if you want to emulate him, that perhaps you ought to learn to eat too? So here's the story.
Well, we just discovered that our guest, Thomas Gosney, chef, is actually a born and bred Texan. Your soul and heart is in Texas, right, Thomas?
Always is. No matter how I bounce around America like a ping pong ball.
And you have done that.
It always falls back to Texas.
Yeah, but you have. You've traveled over some places where I've lived, too. And you said that you were near Kennett Square in Philadelphia.
I was the chef of the Kennett Square Inn, yes. Yes.
Right. And with all the mushrooms.
All the mushroom capital of the world. Yes. In fact, I still correspond with the guy that pretty much gave me my beginning of my career. I was 17 when I ran the Kennett Square Inn. And I remember they kind of wrote articles about me, like, he's not old enough to drink, but he's the chef. I did an apprenticeship when I was in, like, junior year, and actually the chef took off and left, and I was the chef until I went to Johnson & Wales University at the Kennett Square Inn, which is still running right to this day.
Which one, Johnson & Wales, did you go to?
I went to the Providence, Rhode Island one.
Okay. Well, that's
good. We kind of hark around as other Johnson & Wales people, and of course I do lectures and communicate to them all, but whenever we find out which one did you go to, because again, I always felt, and again, that was really the true master chefs that taught us, it was a sacrifice living in Rhode Island in so many ways, but I felt that that is really where the high quality chefs, I remember I got trained by a master baker and all, it's kind of, that was the Harvard that I felt when I went to culinary school.
Now, when did you take your next career direction, which is a really fascinating one, I think, for a chef, but also for our listeners who are interested in sport as well?
Yes. You're talking about after college?
Yes, yeah. I mean, when did you team up with Shaq?
Okay. So, when I was in college, only like 5% get to go on a co-op. The rest kind of have to do a whole working at Johnson & Wales. But I was really fortunate. I worked really hard and got great grades. So I was a 5-diamond chef at the Hyatt Regency Grand Cypress on a co-op. And they actually asked me to come back and work for them. So I was very fortunate, got right out of college, went to there and worked very hard, and then was very successful, became the number 3 guy out of 113 chefs. When I was 25, I was running 7 restaurants. So here we go in this tie-in of what my leap of faith of what I've done for the rest of my career. The corporate executive guy, Pritzker, all these CEOs have terrible health. And he came to the flagship at the time was the Grand Cypress, we're a regional hotel. And he said, how can I'm not being able to eat correctly, how can I go to my hotels and have a nutritional menu? And we blew the paradigm of having the calorie count, nutritional content, and all this. And we were one of the first pioneers of offering a nutritional menu as well as a regular menu, really for the CEO of the company. So I worked with Pam Smith at the time, who was a nutritionist for the Magic, and of course in Orlando. And
because he was in Orlando, because Shaq was in Orlando before he went to the league.
Correct.
I forgot.
Correct. Ironically, I was a corporate boy. We just opened the Hyatt Orlando, the Hyatt at the airport. So when Shaq got drafted, he flew in that first night. I remember I was opening that hotel for the company, and everybody was talking, Shaq. I'm like, who is this guy? And I fed him actually at that hotel first. Now, when we came into this Red Venue, she was doing the nutritionist for the Magic. And then, we had this amazing concept of going into people's homes with a nutritionist and creating healthy menus and kind of keying in with a private chef, kind of pioneering this whole private chef industry. And I took a leap of faith, and, the Grand Cypress still was like, Tom, what are you doing? I'm like, I really think that this is my calling. So at the time, I had Joe Lee, who's the chairman of the board of Darden, Red Lobster, Olive Garden. I had a couple other important people, and Shaq. And because he was 19 years old, and he was drinking 2 2-liter bottles of Sunkist soda and eating McDonald's every day.
Oh, my God. How terrible.
And he realized, this is right when he first came, I can't do this. So at first, I got my feet wet with him, and it was working. He did blue chips. I remember I was doing a thing called, for Darden Foods, I was creating a Bahama Breeze concept. He came back into town, and he was like, hey, Tom, come on over. And I told him, you're going to have to wait. I'm doing something. And I remember him saying when I got there, well, what are you doing? And I said, well, when you're out of town, I'm not getting paid. And he goes, well, I want to buy you out. I want to make a contract with you. Because he realized, like, oh, my gosh, yeah, this guy, if I'm not in town, then I want Thomas for myself. So right then and there, we made a contract. And, of course, I followed him to L.A. and bounced around America. And again, was with him when all of his children were born. And in fact, his youngest son just he friended me on Facebook. I think I'm so tickled to see that. And I didn't even know about Google, but you can Google it up because I've done many things as far as TV shows, kind of the chef behind the Shaq attack. And that's kind of where they labeled me throughout my life. And really
what
gave
did
me a
you
lot of
actually feed him? Did yes. he eat quantities of food?
Well, what we had to do was, he loved to have club sandwiches, and he loved going out at night. So kind of my thing was, I was the no man. He's like, I'm going to go to Jerry's Deli at 2 in the morning sometimes, and you're going to have to figure out the rest. So I was the no man. I had to sit there and say, no, you're not going to have it. And I was the bad guy. I had to formulate recipes and what would make him successful for game day approaches, you know, so we wouldn't carb spike out and he would be listless on the court. So game day scenarios were very vital on how he went to practice, came back for lunch, then he would take a nap, and of course what I would feed him before the game was very imperative to his success as an athlete.
For example, because, what would you feed him?
Well, even back then, we wouldn't carb a load. So it would be something, lots of vegetables, lots of salads for lunch, because that kind of stuff needs digestion. And then, of course, the 4 or 5 o'clock before you went to the game, it was proteins and vegetables again. And then I would usually give them a kind of what we called our secret formula shake. And it was kind of something that was between him and me, and we really kind of held secret, wouldn't let anybody know. It changed every once in a while, but, you know, I was even grinding up flax seeds and stuff like that back in the day just to give him this superpower shake, but without the carb spikes, as we all are so much aware of nowadays.
Now, there was something about him him playing that really almost, like, wasn't fair, because he was so big and so strong, and I understand his BMI was really high. Even though he was a big man, he was a big man, but he was lean for a big man.
He was actually really skinny when he was 19. I kind of had to fatten him up a little bit, but then we really had to watch. Yeah, his BMI, he's always been so very diligent on exercising and realizing this was his bread and butter. And I always interpret him, and I always laughed about, he's a racehorse, and that's how I envisioned him. This is a racehorse that needs to win the Kentucky Derby. I mean, if he takes off and he only goes around the track 3/4 of the way, and then all the horses run by him at the finish line, then we didn't do it right.
No,
so I always looked at him as a racehorse. Go ahead.
Now we've forgotten. We're having so much fun here, we've forgotten the real purpose of this interview.
I had one other
interview.
Question.
Go ahead, sweetheart.
Well, go ahead.
You know, I see you've been affiliated with Julie Bauer on the Today Show frequently.
Yes.
And I don't think that's fair. She is petite by nature. And, you know, and really, I'm sure she's very healthily. Nobody's going to end up looking like that, eating the stuff that she's telling us to eat.
You know, I laugh about the nutritionist because, again, Pam Smith, as I already mentioned to you in Orlando, nutritionists are always the same kind of people. They're always these, yes, very petite, very sweet, energetic, wonderful ladies, but they all kind of look the same, and they're, in a sense, it's not fair, like you say, for what they perceive. But I always find that nutritionists always are kind of like the same kind of person as I go through my life. Joy's a very good friend. I just talked to her recently. She's an amazing person. We really see eye to eye on a lot of things and have the same passions about trying to help America. You know, she's done so much. I think I'll probably go on the Today Show later on, hopefully, once I get done this fall. Just because in my book, I don't like to label it as a nutritional book. I call it New Age because I have traditional recipes and I have a lot of things that just are, I call food for life.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about here. This book that Peter was indicating we're supposed to be talking about is called Method of Procedure, which I think is a peculiar name, to be perfectly honest. I had no idea what it meant. It's subtitled The Guide and Techniques for Excellent Cuisine.
No, be careful.
Which also, I don't understand what it means.
He chose the title, so you better be careful.
Well, but at any rate, you do say that it's a new age cookbook. I mean, I find it really very traditional, so I'm going to ask you to point out what is innovative and new age about it.
Yeah, I kind of go both sides of the spectrum because there are certain things, like I told you, make brisket and barbecue sauce. I have my grandmother's bread pudding that I altered, and again, I have people all over America that just have been dying to get that recipe, and I have never shared it with people. But then as I learned how to eat and what makes my body feel good, throughout there, I have salad dressings that don't have vinegar in it. Most of my entree recipes are these beautiful seared fish with hot broth that we pour over vegetables. Instead of making grits, I make grits out of cauliflower and coconut milk. And again, it's very, very good stuff. I mean, I have people that are just so pleased to eat it. So as I've gone through as a modern-day chef, I don't like to label paleo diet or all these fad diets because, you know, they come and go. And so I have things in there that I feel that are very traditional, but then I make chocolate mousse out of coconut milk. And I make a sugar-free and a dairy-free chocolate mousse. So
what about ambrosia salad? I hadn't seen that in a magazine or a cookbook for probably 15 to 20 years.
And then I go, yes, and just like you say, I go back because every you know, around the 4th of July, I really loved ambrosia. And nobody made it right, or it was very leaky and bleedy and just wasn't the style. And the method of procedure I did, I made it. And I always remember people throughout my life that are like, Thomas, you need to make ambrosia salad. Or how did you know, you know, and as I go through my life, people, when they want me to go to their barbecue, they're like, we don't care what you bring, but you got to bring that ambrosia salad. So I earmarked that because I wanted to make sure people knew how to make this wonderful fruit salad that was kind of a traditional thing, but it just didn't have enough oomph. And maybe they just weren't putting enough fresh fruit in it, or they didn't toast the macadamia nuts. I thought that texture crunch really was a big thing as far as that salad was.
Well, you don't even make your own marshmallows, which is very trendy right now. You buy them.
Very trendy. Everybody really has been making marshmallows lately. I can see that, huh? Yes, I mean, well, in that sense, I wasn't really concerned with that last aspect. I'll make homemade mayonnaises and homemade dressings at any time, and as we already discussed, you should never buy barbecue sauce from the grocery store. It's so easy to make yourself. But I guess I never really thought about, you know, at that point when you do that ambrosia, I don't think it was that imperative to make your own marshmallows. Anybody, bless their heart, if they want to continue to take it to the next level. I always love constant improvement. Uh-huh. And I'm always analyzing what we can do better, even the recipes that we have.
Well, Peter commented that he has, of course, you know, he grew up in the north of England. His first shock in the United States was Jell-O salad. And his second shock was Waldorf salad. So you have a new age Waldorf salad. What do you do it that makes changes?
I'm glad you mentioned that. Because, again, going into these things a new age techniques, about 5 or 6 of those salads don't have vinegar in it. Because as I do high-end clients, a lot of these people have health problems, and vinegar kind of is not always the greatest thing to put in our bodies, besides organic apple cider vinegar. So what it is, the New Age Waldorf and a couple of the jicama salad and the golden beet salad is an acetosis. So it's actually where you're going to extract the natural juices from the vegetables from using lemon juice or lime juice and salt. And it's about a period, as I kind of timed it out. If you go 15, 20 minutes, you're going to have this limp mush. And if you go too little, it hasn't extracted its natural juices. So what I kind of wanted to do was, I wasn't going to use walnuts, I did pecans, but I wanted to do this apple salad, this healthy thing that wasn't this mayonnaise-laden celery walnut salad. So what I did was, as I played with it, I find that about 8 minutes into adding the lemon and the salt, all of a sudden the sweetness comes out of all these vegetables, and it extracts its own natural, beautiful salad dressing, its own juices. And that's what I used in that. It really makes things sweet, and it's still crisp. It's just this window of opportunity that it just makes this wonderful, flavorful, sweet. It actually makes it even sweeter. But then all of a sudden, it creates its own salad dressing at the same time. And yes, I felt that it's just this simple thing that a lot of people aren't looking at, that you don't always have to make a salad dressing. The salad can make its own dressing.
Interesting. And the other thing I should mention is you advocate for kimchi and have a recipe for this. And everybody's discovering that fermented foods really have amazing health benefits. And kimchi is often referenced as a good source of that. And you say once it's made, it never goes bad.
Well, you can always make it into soup. And as my girlfriend for 15 years is Korean.
Okay.
So
well,
I went and I
do
learned
happen
from
to like. I like kimchi soup, by the way. I love it.
Oh, kimchi jjigae. Yes.
Yeah.
And again, if it goes too sour or too strong for you. But as we know that all this probiotics, it really shouldn't be in a pill. You know, you can make pickles without the vinegar as well, just by the this whole natural fermentation. Again, the Koreans have had this figured out. They eat it every day. But as I analyze...
Are you saying that we should take this in a pill form?
Well, no, I say that everybody's taking a probiotic pill and they shouldn't.
I agree with you. I think they should eat fermented foods. Yeah.
Yeah, like pickles and sauerkraut and kimchi. I mean, these are amazing things. You don't need it in this pill form. I'm so against pills, and I think food heals itself.
Me too, yeah.
But as I analyzed, and of course we go to the Korean market and we buy food, my girlfriend Sue and I, we laugh because... kimchi's so expensive to buy.
Is it
and
really?
It's so easy to make. I watched their aunts make it so many times. And it's something that, you know, it's a necessity. Here, Napa cabbage is 50 cents a pound, and kimchi's $8 to $10 for a bag or, you know, about a pound of it. So it's kind of out of necessity. And also, kind of as I view trends, of course, I go to Korean restaurants. Well, of course, that whole thing has been really big now, and I've watched the Korean restaurants observe that, wow, all of a sudden we got all these Americans coming in and eating our food, and the bulgogi and the kabikui is basically all Americans want, and that price has tripled. And, yes, right, as I watch these menu prices go up, and of course we sit back and go, well, we'll just go home and make that ourselves now. That it costs $25 for kabikui. But the Koreans have figured out the Americans are really into their trendy food. And then I am a realist. I sit back and go, you know, what are they eating? They're not eating anything but kabi, a little rice, and kimchi. So, again, I offer that in my book. So it's not that complicated. And, you know, of course, go out to the Korean restaurants and dine, but... You can do this as an alternative barbecue on the 4th of July. It's something that pretty much all Koreans usually do at home anyways. But the kimchi, I think, is a very important thing because it's that probiotic for the gut. And it's so vital to consume on just to keep your balance in because yogurt, I don't think, is always doing the best thing for us. And definitely don't want to take a pill for it.
Right. Well, I agree with you. Again, Thomas, it's Thomas Gosney, and it's called The Method of Procedure. And
right.
He is very deceptive in a way because he gives you tried and true recipes and dishes that are loaded with nostalgia, but he changes them around and gives them a healthy bent. And if you want that, then this is the book for you. Well, thanks for talking to us, Thomas, and good luck with your book and your ongoing projects.
Oh, again, I'm just glad that we had time to share with this. And again, I just hope people can get something from this. Again, my whole thing with Method of Procedure is, as they talk to me about this, it's, you know, you can find a recipe anywhere, but it's how you do the technique of the cooking. It's the method of procedure where I found that people were not succeeding in. That's why I wrote this book. It's not a cup of flour, a cup of sugar. Anybody can get that. And that's kind of why I did it in detail, like I'm standing next to you in the kitchen trying to guide you into successful cuisine and giving you full detail so you will not have... You will not mess the recipe up. And that's kind of why I wrote the book.
Straightforward, Thomas. I thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, bless you, and thank you for your time as well.
Well, once again, I'd like to point out, although we're wild about food and drink and travel, that it's really the people in this world, this culinary world or whatever you'd like to call it, that is the main attraction. We love the conversations, the personalities that we encounter, the new ideas and the idea exchanges. And we hope that you do too.
Yeah, as I said, we hope you do too. And until next week when we'll have more of the same.
Bye-bye.